Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Just this week, vaccinations for the coronavirus began in the United Kingdom, and public health officials say highest-risk individuals in the U.S. will likely begin to receive the vaccine later this month. Public health experts agree the vaccine is the only way we'll defeat the virus and return to normalcy, yet many people have expressed reluctance to be vaccinated. Later in the hour, we talk about the development of the coronavirus vaccine and the rigorous testing and safety hurdles it must clear before becoming available. And we want to hear from you. Will you get the coronavirus vaccine when it's available? Why or why not? You can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, or give us a call at 866-999-4626. But first, the December 31st deadline for children attending Massachusetts schools, pre-K through college, to be vaccinated for the flu is fast approaching. The state issued this requirement back in August. And joining us to talk about the importance of flu vaccinations this year is pediatrician Dr. Greg Parkinson. Welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what is the rationale behind the state requiring school-aged children to be vaccinated against the flu by the end of the year?
Well, briefly, when more people get the flu vaccine, communities are safer. And so the flu vaccine has always been a good idea. It's been an especially good idea for populations at risk, young children, the elderly, people with diabetes, et cetera. This year, of course, is like no other year, and there's a couple of things. One is, as we hear about the push on the healthcare system, and that's not just ICU beds, but everything down, trickling down as far down as primary care offices and school nurses, anything we can do to reduce the burden of other illnesses than COVID is going to be a good thing. First of all, it will allow people to focus their time more on COVID. Second, it will mean less sick people. And keep in mind that every sick person right now has COVID until they're proven not to, even if it's just a cold, because sometimes the symptoms are mild. And so the number of people who are restricted because of that, as we've all heard in the community, is growing. And so we have to do everything we can to reduce the illnesses that we can to try to be able to stay functional and safe. Mm. And remember as well, Mindy, that, you know, 600 children a year die of the flu. And so it's not a trivial illness. And in fact, for children, it's actually a more severe illness most of the time than COVID is.
So are you seeing more children being vaccinated against the flu? And do you have enough flu vaccine to meet the demand?
Right. So there has been an uptick in flu vaccination, which is a good thing. You know, in large part spurned by the mandate, of course. We have been able to keep up with the demand for it. The state has given us doses as we've needed them. I do have some concerns if there's a last-minute rush the last week of December to meet the deadline that, you know, because we only get the doses in aliquot, that we might not be able to handle the burden if there's too much of a rush.
Nobody enjoys injections, and children even less so. In the past years, there's been a nasal spray flu vaccine, but it hasn't been offered in recent years. Why is that, and do you know if it will return?
There was a problem in terms of it being as effective as the flu shot in previous years. It has come back to the market, and it's sort of an individual decision by every office whether or not they carry it. It does have some more restrictions than the flu vaccine because it is a weakened live virus, whereas the regular flu vaccine is a killed virus, and so many people have just decided to go with the shot because it's more versatile and it's less problematic.
Let me switch over to coronavirus for a minute. Are you seeing coronavirus cases in your pediatric practice? And if so, what age group is most prevalent?
Sure. So, you know, as in the rest of the community, as I like to say, when it's raining outside, it affects what happens inside. In other words, whether it's the schools or in an outpatient office, we've seen the numbers go up. And Scott McGann from the health office here locally was talking about how we've had over 50 cases in Falmouth in the last week. I know Barnstable's gone into the red, unfortunately. And so, yes, we're starting to see more cases than we did. We had a slow trickle, since this has started. We're seeing a significant increase, especially this week. And, I think we all kind of know how that goes. But the important thing is to keep in mind that just because we got through March and April well does not guarantee that we'll do well in December and January. We have to really do the things that helped us to do well back then, recognizing that once it's in the community, it's a much harder battle than when it stays over the bridge.
Yeah. Are the children that you're seeing having mild or asymptomatic cases, or are some of them getting pretty sick?
Well, so that's the double-edged sword, Mindy, of COVID in children, is that it's almost always a very mild illness. We've all heard about the rare situation where it can be severe, but that's a 1 in 100,000, and that can happen in almost any disease. So many, the good news is that even children with underlying conditions tend to get a very mild illness, which looks like a cold, or we'll see somebody be tired for a few days, or very what you'd think of as very mild symptoms ordinarily, and so that's good because children aren't getting sick. But the hard part of that is we all have to change our mindset and not say it's just a cold, because mm-hmm. just a cold in 2020 could be COVID, and even though it may be just a cold or even no symptoms for one person, it can be fatal for someone else.
Yeah. And then finally, what are some of the concerns that you hear from parents and caregivers about having their children inoculated, either for the flu or other diseases?
Well, there's nothing dearer to the heart of pediatricians than immunizations. And the reasons for that are because they do so much good, as an entire entity. We hang our hats on them, and there's nothing that pains us more than when immunizations are, claims are made which are false. I think we've had the benefit of really, really solid information in the past about the efficacy and the possible side effects of the vaccine, so we feel very comfortable, going to the wall for them. I'm pleased that in the last month or so, the information that has come out about the new COVID vaccine has been much more science-based and open than the discussion was earlier. And I'm hoping that that's going to help with the immunization rates, because they do appear to be very good vaccines.
Yeah. I know you're tough for time here. So pediatrician Greg Parkinson, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Mindy.
Thanks. And joining us now is Deirdre Arvidsson. She's the public health nurse for Barnstable County. Welcome, Deirdre.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. So what do we know at this point about the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccination in our region, and when do we expect to learn more?
So the CDC and the ACIP have put together a plan that states can base their plans on. Of course, they had to have their plans in earlier in the month, and Massachusetts has, and you can get it on their website, the Department of Public Health interim draft plan, and it's really based on similar to what the CDC has, where the rollout is in phases. Phase one is basically looking at their expecting an initial allocation of between 20 to 60,000 doses of the vaccine. and it would be prioritized to healthcare personnel that are, you know, likely to be exposed or that treat people with COVID-19, people at increased risk for illness from COVID-19, including those with underlying medical conditions and people 65 years and older. And that's basically what you're looking at for the long-term care facilities, including assisted living. And then, you know, it does, you know, break that down to even a phase one and a phase 1B, because, you know, the vaccine, I mean, the 20 to 60,000 initial doses is not going to cover everybody, even in that, you know, limited amount. And I think we saw this at the beginning of H1N1, where initially the rollout was limited, you know, and yeah. Certain populations were prioritized. I believe this is going to be similar.
So how is the state securing the vaccine? Is it directly with the manufacturers, or is the federal government distributing to states?
Yes, it comes through the federal government, correct.
So, of course, our population in Barnstable County is one of the oldest in the state, maybe one of the oldest in the nation. Will our higher number of seniors be reflected in the number of vaccines that will be available in our region?
Probably not. I think initially, at least, you know, all our long-term care and assisted living folks, you know, will be offered the vaccine. So in that way, yes, we will get enough for those individuals. Outside of that, you know, it really just trickles down. I'm not sure they're going to be looking at exactly how many people we have over age 65. I think once it gets down to us, they'll be giving us a certain amount of vaccine, and then, you know, we distribute it to that age group.
Right. So what kinds of infrastructure will we need to be in place to administer the vaccine? And will the state provide funding for this infrastructure, or will it come down to cities and towns?
Well, you know, honestly, this infrastructure is somewhat already in place. All towns have emergency preparedness plans, including distribution sites, emergency dispensing sites. You know, and mm-hmm. over the, you know, in October, many of the towns chose to do, including us at the county, chose to do drive-through flu clinics. So we have, each town has their own plan, and to dispense in an emergency medication, vaccine, whatever is necessary. And so that will probably be what's used, and the sites that the towns that did do drive-throughs, it was kind of a dry run for COVID vaccine.
Yeah, so the drive-through flu shot clinics have worked, as you're saying, in many towns. So we could use this technique to administer to, you know, once it becomes more widely available.
Yes, we could.
And so what is your message to people who are concerned about the safety of the coronavirus vaccine?
Well, you know, I think everybody, you know, has their own decision to make. If they're concerned, do the research, look at reputable sites and reputable studies, and, you know, make an individual decision. You know, this country has been producing vaccines to prevent infectious disease for a long time, for decades, and it's been successful. You know, we've reduced communicable disease such as diphtheria to like zero in this country. And so it plays a huge role. I mean, my dad had polio growing up. And that was before the vaccine. And, you know, he suffered later in life from it. So it's important. It's important, but I don't, you know, I never push anybody. I just give people the facts and, you know, encourage them to do the research.
Yeah. Do we have the infrastructure in the towns for keeping the vaccine cold, you know, the one that we need to keep at that lower temperature?
Right. The Pfizer vaccine, no, they don't. But we are here at the county ordering one of those ultra-cold freezers that we'll probably get next month. So we will have that capacity if, you know, if the state does ship it to us. But the towns on an individual basis, no.
Okay. So bring us up to speed on new coronavirus testing locations and how people can make use of these facilities.
Okay. So the one that's open in Hyannis, or is opening in Hyannis, is run by Cape Cod Healthcare. And emergency EMTs will be doing some of the testing. You have to schedule all test sites are by appointment, and this is to help avoid those huge long lines that you see on TV. You know, right. We don't have the space for that, so it's by appointment online, and same with Falmouth. The Falmouth site is on the fairgrounds, and our nurses here from the county will be doing the testing. So it's a real collaborative effort. To try to increase testing for people in our county when the state won't give us stop the spread test site. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important because, you know, people do come here from other states, whether we like it or not, they do. And most people want to do the right thing and get a test, you know, to find out if they're, you know, so they don't have to quarantine for 2 weeks. So to have that available is, I think, really important. Mm-hmm.
So we have it at the Melody Tent, at the fairgrounds,
correct.
And then we have two sites are coming, Wellfleet and Provincetown, right?
Outer Cape Health will be, Outer Cape Health will be administering the testing, which is going to be purchased by the county.
All right. Deirdre Arvidsson, she's the public health nurse for Barnstable County. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Mindy, anytime.
You bet. Thanks. We're talking about vaccine safety and the importance of getting vaccinated this hour. We want to hear from you. Will you get the coronavirus vaccine when it's available to you? Why or why not? You can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, or give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about vaccine safety and the importance of getting vaccinated this hour. And joining us is Michael DeSpezio. He's a biologist, educator, and science author. He's created a blog to help people navigate through the science of the virus. Welcome back, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
So should we be confident in the safety of the vaccine despite the speed with which it's been developed and tested?
Yes. My personal feeling is that the development of any vaccine goes through a number of phases, which really ensures the safety. And although we've certainly arrived at these vaccines much sooner than might have been anticipated a year ago, I believe it is going through all of the safety gates. You've got various types of phases, an exploratory phase, which would normally take years. However, and during this phase, you look for targets on how a vaccine would work, but within the first month of the discovery of the virus, we were already looking at the genome, the blueprints of the virus, and already getting an idea of what these targets would most likely be. So then we went to preclinical trials, and these preclinical trials looked at mice and monkeys and looked for the correct immune response and also checking on safety. Then we went through another phase, and then we went through clinical phases, the phase one, where, again, we're looking at safety and effectiveness. Then we went through phase two, which involved several hundred individuals, and this was evaluating doses and how many, what the effect would be on the immune response. And all along, we're still looking at safety. And finally, there was phase three, which we're coming out of right now, which involved tens of thousands of individuals. And in this case, again, looking at the safety. And anytime there's a question with safety, the phase is immediately halted and people begin to look. And that's what happened with the Oxford vaccine, for example. Mm-hmm. There were several individuals which came out with immune responses, which were probably triggered by something else, not getting the vaccine, but that halted that phase until the investigators and researchers took a deeper dive into what was causing that illness.
So some people are concerned that the FDA is rushing through the approval of the vaccine and that it might be politically motivated. So what has the FDA done to speed up the regulatory process, and how transparent has it been about the vetting process of the vaccine?
Great questions. There are some recent articles about how long the vaccine, how long will it take for this vaccine to be approved, whether it'll be approved in a week or two, or whether it might take longer. The FDA might take a week or so to look at it. From what I can tell, it's quite transparent. They sped up the process in two major ways. The first way was that they gave guidance to the drug companies for developing a quicker feedback loop. So when the drug companies would have their initial questions about proceeding on vaccine trials, they were in direct communication with the FDA, which would help them along. So we had that. Also, at the time, we had a lot of sharing of information among different groups. All this was somewhat under an umbrella of partnerships, and it was really guided by a lot of input from the FDA on looking for the best vaccine candidates. In addition, the FDA took more of an active role in helping the third phase and going through the trial phase and setting this up, making sure that you picked a diverse group. So the FDA took a much greater role in the development of these vaccines. However, that said, we're still looking at there's always a possibility, a remote possibility out of 100,000, 200,000 people, that there might be some sort of ill effect. And we've seen that in the past with certain types of vaccine programs.
How do the various coronavirus vaccines work? Because we have several, right? And how are they different from the traditional vaccines for like the flu and measles, et cetera?
Great question. Well, there are a number of different types of vaccines that are out there. The current ones that we're looking at right now are called nucleic acid vaccines. And these are different from the vaccines that most people are familiar with. I believe most of you have been inoculated for measles, mumps, and that's with a live but weakened pathogen. And your body responds to this infection by building up immunity. Another type of vaccination uses inactivated germs. And these are germs that are killed. The flu shot's an example of that, or polio shot. You get the inactivated germ, and your body, again, responds to that germ, to proteins on the germ, to antigens, and builds up immunity. What we're looking at now are nucleic acid vaccines. These are the Pfizer, the Moderna, the Oxford vaccine. And what they do is so incredible. They introduce a blueprint into your cells for making only a part of that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. So they really go right into your cell, go to what are called protein factories, and tell the cells not to make the proteins that would keep your cells healthy, but you know what? You're going to change your direction now, and you are going to build the spike protein from the virus. So the cells build, manufacture the spike protein, release it into your bloodstream. Your body sees this foreign antigen, this foreign protein, not the germ, but just that spike, and reacts to it and builds up not only antibodies, but T cell populations. And we could talk more about that later. What this does is it primes you to quickly react to the actual virus if and when that virus ever appears. And that's how these nucleic acid vaccines work. Some of them are RNA-based, and others are DNA-based.
So how long have researchers been studying and developing protein-based vaccinations? I mean, is this new?
Protein-based, what you're probably getting at there is the same type of nucleic acid type of vaccine, because the protein base, we look at antigens. Antigens can be other types of substances, but many of them are proteins. But if we're looking at nucleic acid vaccines, this research began actually in the 90s, and it had a great promise for vaccine development. However, it was never realized. The effectiveness of these proto-vaccines was... they never found in the research. However, as we've learned more and more over the decades, we've gotten to the point that we started developing these nucleic acid vaccines soon after we identified the coronavirus as being the cause of COVID-19.
So because this is among the first protein-based vaccinations, many people have concerns because we won't have long-term data. For example, will it be safe for pregnant people? Could it impact fertility? What about its impact on people with other conditions?
Okay, good, great questions. As far as pregnant individuals, yes, we don't have a... risk.
All right.
However, the Society for Maternal and Fetal Medicine recommends access to COVID-19 vaccines to individuals who are pregnant. So that is out there. As far as infertility, that's interesting because I think that arises from someone posting to social media that there were components in the vaccines which would make you infertile. Again, this was fake news that was out there. Mm-hmm. So that is really not the case, because what these vaccines contain really are delivery packets. These are packets. These are like oil droplets that within this very tiny, tiny, tiny oil droplet, you have that RNA blueprint. The RNA has been modified, that nucleic acid has been modified a little bit to make it more stable and more effective in hijacking the cell machinery to make virus parts. However, that is basically what it is. So you don't have drugs in there that are going to affect one's fertility.
All right. We have an email says, regarding today's vaccine topic on the point, I'm curious if those who already had COVID should consider getting vaccinated this round. As a first responder, I feel like I'm constantly coming in contact with the virus, and I don't know how long my immunity will last. To date, I've donated 2 units of convalescent plasma through the American Red Cross, and each donation contained high levels of antibodies. But these donations were back in the summer, and as the year drags on, my worries about reinfection grow. Good question.
Fantastic question. And you know what? We don't know. We don't know how long immunity will last. If we look at comparisons and we look at other coronaviruses, and we see that this immunity might last for months, for several years, we just don't know. What we can see by looking at antibody levels in individuals with COVID-19, or if we looked at individuals that had, say, MERS or SARS-related coronavirus diseases, we find that the antibodies certainly begin to fall among the population. So an individual's response may begin to drop. Now, the question is whether or not should that individual get vaccinated. My suggestion, if I was that person, I certainly would, because you don't know how quickly those antibodies will fall. But, you know, I'm saying antibodies, but we have to look at the concept that immunity is much more than antibodies. It also goes back to what I referred to before, T-cell populations. T-cells are immune cells that are in your body, and there's 2 specific populations that epidemiologists, researchers look for to ensure that viable immunity is established. One population is what are called helper T cells, and these are cells which are much like the generals of your immune response. They really ramp up different parts of your immunity. They are critical to a valid immune response. In fact, you may remember back to when there was the HIV pandemic 20, 30 years ago. HIV, that virus specifically targeted the helper T cells, which was insidious, because what you had was it was attacking and killing the very cells that would govern the immune response. Okay, so you need to develop helper T cells. You also need to develop another type of T cell called a cytotoxic cell. And these cytotoxic cells may be the ones you might think of when you consider these amoeba-type cells that would engulf foreign particles and destroy them. So what we want to do to establish immunity is to develop a high enough level of these neutralizing antibodies. Antibodies will attack the actual foreign protein that comes in, and you also want to build up the populations of both your helper T cells and your killer T cells.
Now, he mentions donating 2 units of convalescent plasma through the American Red Cross. What's that all about? Tell us about that.
That's great, and that is a very noble thing to do. So thank you very much for doing that. Convalescent plasma. Once you fight off the disease, your body still has the immune chemicals circulating in the blood. So one way to protect people or to help people who are suffering from the disease is to take this convalescent plasma, the plasma from the blood. Because remember, blood is more than those donut-shaped RBCs, the red blood cells, or the white amoeba-like cells that are in there. It's mostly a straw-colored fluid called plasma. And within that plasma, all sorts of things are carried or dissolved in it. And some of those pieces that are in that plasma are antibodies. And in fact, if you remove the blood from somebody who has recovered from COVID-19, then separate out the plasma, that plasma has the potential to help a new person who is sick with COVID-19. And in fact, many of you probably are familiar now with what are called monoclonal antibodies. This is a new treatment that's been approved. And what monoclonal antibodies are a concentration of the best antibodies that were in convalescent plasma. So you look for the antibodies which are most effective in destroying COVID-19, you pull those out of the plasma, then you bring them into a laboratory situation where you manufacture much, much more of them, and this becomes a therapy which President Trump had when he was infected with COVID-19, and this becomes a therapy that can address the infection before it gets to its most serious phases.
We're talking about the development of the coronavirus vaccine with Michael DeSpezio. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about vaccine safety. With us, Michael DeSpezio. He's a biologist, educator, and science author. He's created a blog to help people navigate through the science of the coronavirus. 866-999-4626 is our number. Will you get the coronavirus vaccination when it's made available to you? Why or why not? You can also send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got a couple of emails. The first email says, I never take a new drug for years until we see what kind of serious side effects show up. Efficacy is one thing, but longer term results may show up. There are no guarantees, I know, but personally, I think I'll wait. I'm 71 and being very careful. Just listen to the doctor currently speaking and hear him, but still. And then Barb says, I'm a healthy 70-year-old and plan to get the vaccine when it's available. I understand that the vaccine protects you from getting COVID, but that it's not yet known if it prevents you from harboring or shedding the virus. A doctor friend of mine reminded me that there was the Salk vaccine and later the Sabin that prevented the spread. Is there work on the second problem? Do we know, Michael?
Okay, so let me see if I can dissect all of what you just presented, and let me know if I miss anything. First of all, no one knows now that if you get the vaccine, if you're going to be getting a case, if you will be getting COVID-19, but it would be asymptomatic. If that indeed happens, there's a chance that although you'll be vaccinated, your body will have enough immunity to fight off the infection so that you don't have symptoms. However, you would be harboring the virus, which would then be shedding, which means that you would be an asymptomatic spreader, which could be a very dangerous situation for others who are around you because you're acting as if you're totally protected from the virus and not carrying the virus, where actually you might be carrying the virus, although not showing symptoms of it. Now, the whole concept that you're getting at here really gets back to something called risk assessment. And we've got to be able to make value judgments on what we think are acceptable and non-acceptable risks. And this really falls back to a personal decision, and one has to look at it. I mean, if you look at the numbers of people who are most impacted, their health is most impacted by COVID-19, it is certainly an older population. So we have to look at that and weigh that in for risk assessment. If indeed there's a chance that if you get COVID-19, you are more likely to proceed to the most serious symptoms, life-threatening symptoms, maybe that risk assessment is saying that you should be one of the first people to get it. However, it becomes that individual decision, because as what was pointed out, we don't know the long-term effects. I mean, we are not going to turn into zombies. We're not going to have a third leg that's going to grow because we're taking a nucleic acid vaccine, but there certainly is always the chance. It is an extremely slim chance that there is going to be an effect later on, but one needs to weigh that against the very real data that we have now on the impact of COVID-19, especially on the at-risk individuals or individuals who are at risk of proceeding to the most severe symptoms.
That's interesting about the shedding. I had not realized that. So what percentage of the population will need to be vaccinated to create that herd immunity?
Ah, great question. Let me go back to herd immunity now, because there are a lot of misconceptions around it. Herd immunity occurs when a certain percentage of the population has immunity to the pathogen. Now, herd immunity considers both the naturally infected people, and that's where the misconception comes in, that people in the past have talked about herd immunity only arising from natural infections. However, herd immunity looks at the numbers of people who are infected naturally and adds that to the number of people who have been vaccinated. Both of those groups have immunity. We don't know how long that's going to last, but they have immunity to that pathogen. The current belief, and these numbers have changed over time because, you know, science is something that keeps changing. As we learn more, we change our understanding. There was a time when as low as 40% of the population needed to have immunity until we reached herd immunity. Now, I believe the latest places herd immunity at 70% of the population need to have immunity either by prior infection, and we don't know how long that's going to last, or through vaccination. Now, let me backtrack a little and explain what herd immunity is. Herd immunity is a way of isolating that virus so that it cannot spread rapidly among the population. So it's almost as if the virus could travel from an island to an island and island and island hop. And what you're doing with herd immunity is removing some of those intermediate islands so that virus cannot effectively spread out to all sorts of local potential hosts. So what you do with herd immunity is you cut down the spread of the disease. The disease still spreads. You can still be infected by it if herd immunity is out there, but the chances for a widespread spread of the virus, for an epidemic, a pandemic, becomes lessened as more and more people obtain immunity to that pathogen.
Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Good morning. I am a 79-year-old woman in pretty good health. I do have a condition called polymyalgia rheumatica, and I'm a little concerned about taking the vaccine until I talk to a knowledgeable physician of what could happen negatively or not so. I also have regular allergies, hay fever, et cetera, and I don't know what effect the RNA would have on this disease, the shot that has that. Can you answer my questions?
Now, that is a great question. What I would suggest is to go on to the CDC site. And there's a number of sites which do talk about other disorders that people might have which would mostly compromise their health even further if they come down with COVID-19. In most cases, these are the individuals who need to be best protected, and highly suggested that they do get the vaccine. My assumption is that there might be certain types of disorders that are out there which might show some sort of reaction. Your reaction might not be specifically to the development of the virus protein when the vaccine, when the RNA vaccine takes over the cell, but it might be a reaction to the RNA itself because it's modified slightly, or it might be some sort of reaction to just having foreign particles which are not self, which are not recognized by the body, coming in, and your body might overreact to them. So I would look, if you have specifics, more to the CDC site and see where they point out to. The other thing which I would suggest is put in, and this goes for everyone, if you have a certain disorder, if you have an illness, I would put that in a search, in a web search, because often you will be directed to specific scientific papers, and the abstract would be understandable, which might pertain to the risk assessment that applies to your specific condition.
Yeah. Janet, thanks for calling. So, Michael, how is the virus mutating, and will this be an issue for long-term effectiveness of the vaccine? I mean, is it going to be like the flu, what mutates and we have to get it every year?
Well, good question. Let me answer that second part first. You know, as it stands now, there's a good chance that we're going to have to get boosters for this virus, because from what we know of respiratory viruses, the immunity does not last for many years. It seems to last for a few years. We're not sure where that cutoff point is, but again, we don't know. We don't know specifically. So most likely, we are going to have to get some sort of booster. Now, that first part of the question, repeat that again to me, please.
The first part, I've lost my train of thought now. What was I asking? I was asking about the mutating.
Yes. And I lost my train of thought as well.
Yeah.
Yes, viruses mutate. And for those not familiar with that, is that you have these blueprints in your body. And the blueprints are stored in the master blueprint, which is called DNA, which most people are familiar with. There's another nucleic acid which makes copies of that DNA and brings it out to those protein factories that I talked about, and that is called RNA. So we have those nucleic acids. Now, over time, what will happen is that organisms and viruses will mutate. There will be changes in their genetic code. Now, what it appears to be is that the parts of the virus that we are targeting in these types of vaccines, the genetic part which determines the genetic code, which determines those protein parts, seems to be very stable. They're conservative, meaning that they don't undergo many mutations. Plus, we're looking at multiple sites. So most likely, the vaccine will not be affected by these smaller mutations which take place, since they will be involving other parts of that blueprint. Or if they do involve a part of the spike protein, there are going to be other antibodies which will be elicited, will be triggered by the introduction of these vaccine molecules. So, yes, there is a concern about mutations. However, realistically, it seems as if they are not going to impact us. Now, you bring that up. It's interesting because a number of weeks ago, you may have read about minks being culled in Denmark, because what they found was that there were COVID-19 viruses in these mink populations which had a mutation, and this had either jumped into the human population or from the humans it jumped into the mink population. We still don't know which way it traveled. But this presents a possibility that there would be a reservoir of these viruses in another set of organisms, like the bats, which there are already in China. But this would be in the mink population, where there would be mutations resulting in types of virus particles which did not respond to the immune chemicals that a person would produce in response to vaccination. So those minks were culled. I mean, there was a lot of political postings on that, and they're looking at other mink populations around the world. But certainly mutations can impact. However, it appears as if mutations will not impact the effectiveness of these vaccines, at least not in the short run.
All right. Tim writes, how come none of these experts describe the certification process and state that you won't be the first to take the vaccine?
I know, 60,000
people took it as part of the certification process. These are their characteristics and their responses. So, yep.
You know what? The phone blanked out. Try it one more time. The signal is going in and out right here.
How come none of these experts describe the certification process and state that you won't be the first to take the vaccine? 60,000 people took it as part of the certification process, and these are their characteristics and responses.
Well, looking at this concept, how would you be, you know, our phone line connection is going. I lost the beginning part of that, but let's look at your question again. Was on the order of which people would receive the vaccine?
No, he's wondering about why we don't talk more about the certification process. You know, when we're looking at the risk assessment, that there've already been 60,000 people.
The certification process for what?
Yeah.
For individuals or for the vaccine officials?
For the vaccine. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, that is part of that FDA process and looking at the efficiency for it. I mean, if we're looking at specifically, let's say, the Moderna vaccine, in phase three, the last set of phases, there were 30,000 individuals which were part of that phase three clinical study. Half of those, 15,000, received the vaccine itself. 15,000 received a placebo. And then what you do is over time you watch both of those groups and you're looking at how many people will naturally get the infection. So they're back out there in the public, they're interacting with people. And in this phase three study on the Moderna vaccine, after the study was completed, and these are the latest results, at the end of the phase three trial, they had 196 individuals out of the 30,000 came down with COVID-19. Now then you begin to look, how many of those individuals had the vaccine, how many had the placebo? Well, in that group, there was 185 individuals had the placebo, while 11 had the actual vaccine. So then we set up a ratio of that 11 to 185. We do the math. We come up with a vaccine effectiveness, and this is what I'm assuming they're meaning by certifiable vaccines. We come up with a vaccine effectiveness of about 94.1%, which really is off the scale with what our expectations were. Now, I might also add to that the effectiveness against severe COVID-19 was 100%. Mm-hmm. So the people who were vaccinated that did test positive for the virus were basically either asymptomatic or had very mild symptoms. So you can see how effective, how certifiable that vaccine was. So I assume that is what we are getting there with looking at effectiveness. But I also have to say one more thing.
The really quick, we're running out of time.
A
really
silver
quick.
Silver bullet. We are going to see tens of thousands of more deaths over these next few months. These next few months are going to be a very dim time in human history.
Okay. Michael DeSpezio, biologist, educator, and science author. We'll post links to his coronavirus blog as well as links to more information about vaccines at our website, capeandislands.org. Michael, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.